You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
His Excellency President Paul Kagame and distinguished guests, it is my honor to welcome you to the Brookings Institution today for a discussion on the future of the African Union. My name is Liaquat Ahmed. I'm a member of the Brookings Board of Trustees. Brookings has a tradition of bringing together a wide range of individuals and groups with diverse opinions and backgrounds to engage in important discussions and debates. This includes regularly hosting heads of state and senior officials and providing a forum for them to share their views and debate important topics and have a discussion with our audience. Brookings' commitment to institutional independence is rooted in the individual independence of our scholars, and the institution does not take positions on policy issues. Our mission is to conduct high-quality, independent research to inform public debate on global issues. President Kagame has kindly agreed to join us at the invitation of the Brookings Africa Growth Initiative. AGI, as it's known as, believes that the time is right for Africa to sustainably and inclusively converge with the rest of the world in terms of standards of living, opportunity, and GDP per capita. For Africa to achieve this transformative growth, regional leaders and partners need new models and policies for economic development. AGI supports this process by producing and disseminating high-quality independent policy research, which helps establish long-term strategies for economic growth. Dr. Brahimi Koulibaly, known as Kool, who joined Brookings about 6 months ago, is the director of the program and senior fellow in the Global Economy and Development Department. He comes to Brookings from the Federal Reserve Board, where he was chief economist in charge of emerging markets. Under his direction, AGI is continuing the tradition of providing evidence-based research on the policies, institutions, and reforms needed to promote inclusive growth in Africa. And we are delighted to hold this conversation today with President Kagame. His Excellency Paul Kagame was sworn in as President of the Republic of Rwanda for a third term in August 2017. Earlier in the year, in response to a request from AU member states, President Kagame presented a report on the proposed recommendations for the institutional reform of the African Union. It identifies concrete steps to make the AU more effective. This report, whose recommendations were adopted by the AU Assembly, highlights several strategies for revitalizing AU reform. They fall into four broad categories. Realigning AU institutions to deliver its priorities, managing the AU effectively at both the political and operational levels, and sustainably self-financing the AU. On this last point, the report stresses the importance of implementing the Kigali financing decision, which directs all AU member states to implement a 0.2% levy on eligible imports to finance the AU. According to the implementation timeline, the target for the completion of these reports is January 2019. That's an ambitious yet attainable goal. During today's discussion, we look forward to hearing from the President his perspective on the AU reform process and how a reformed AU will better serve the interests of the African citizens. After that, my colleague Kuhl will join President Kagame for a moderated discussion, which will provide you and the audience an opportunity to ask questions. Today's event is being webcast live, and those of you on Twitter, please feel free to join in the discussion using the hashtag AUReform. Now it is my pleasure to welcome to the stage His Excellency Paul Kagame, President of Rwanda.
Mr. Liaquat Ahmed, Brookings Trustee, Dr. Ibrahim Koulibaly, Director of the African Growth Initiative, scholars of the Brookings Institute, members of the Diplomatic Corps, distinguished ladies and gentlemen. I am very pleased to be with you this afternoon, and I would like to begin by thanking the Brookings Institution for the invitation. When Straub Talbot proposed a conversation about the African Union reforms, I immediately accepted. A more effective African Union is not only good for Africa, but for everybody else as well. That's why this discussion comes at the right moment. Let me share a bit of background with you. You may know that the African Union is mostly financed by external partners. In fact, our programs are in the range of 97% donor funded. This reality makes no sense for anyone involved. Africa's interests, including ownership, get lost. And I doubt that the interests of donors are being adequately addressed either. It is also unsustainable. The rapid changes taking place in the global economic and political environment make plain the recklessness of relying so heavily on sources of funding that are likely to dry up sooner rather than later, even when they still exist, they are tied. Meanwhile, Africa has the means to pay for programs that we value, and we should do so. 2 years ago, in this context, African heads of state appointed Donald Kaberuka, who is here, assisted by Achaleke, we have also seen around, Carlos Lopez, and others, to identify alternative sources of funding for the African Union, as well as its new peace funding. Their proposal, which was adopted at the Kigali summit in July 2015, 16, was to institute a 0.2% levy on eligible imports to finance African Union activities. This decision immediately brought the African Union's effectiveness and capability into sharp focus. We simply had to make it work. After all, when it's your own money, you naturally want to be sure that it's being well spent. As a result, I was tasked by the heads of state to supervise the completion of the stalled institutional reform process and submit a plan of action at the next summit. My first response was to ask for help from a team of distinguished experts from around our continent, including the others I mentioned earlier. Our method was not particularly novel. We built on the work of others, and we consulted widely with stakeholders all over Africa. We found that the African Union's problems had already been analyzed in meticulous detail over the years and good solutions identified. The report made to the Assembly of Heads of State in January 2017 presented the most relevant and urgent recommendations, grouped into five reform areas, which are in brief as follows. First, focus on fewer priorities that are continental in scope. Second, make sure the various African Union institutions are able to deliver against those priorities. Third, connect the African Union to its citizens. Fourth, manage African Union business more efficiently, both politically and operationally. Fifth, finance the African Union sustainably. The recommendations were adopted more or less in full and now serve as the basis of the reform agenda, being implemented by the new chairperson of the African Union Commission, Musa Faki Mahamat, and his team. From the outset, we were conscious that the risk of failure was real. Reforms had been adopted before, then fallen into oblivion. The complexity of the politics cannot be underestimated. Change is required not only in the African Union Commission, but also in each of the more than 50 member states. That's why the politics is being taken seriously. First, a reform implementation unit has been established in the office of the chairperson of the African Union to drive implementation over the next year and a half. Second, it was decided to institute a mechanism to ensure that legally binding African Union decisions are respected by member states. Finally, the Assembly took the unusual step of mandating me, assisted by current president or chair of the African Union, President Conde of Guinea, and the previous president or chair of the African Union, President Deby of Chad, together to work on the supervising of the implementation process. Our role is to ensure that the chairperson of the African Union Commission has the support he needs, and very importantly, to maintain regular consultation with the heads of state and other key stakeholders along the way. In closing, I would like to draw your attention to one critical important aspect of the reform agenda, and that is ensuring that Africa speaks with one voice on the global stage. This will require some accommodation and adjustment in terms of how we do business with each other. But it should be seen as a positive evolution, not a challenge to the existing order. A more unified and assertive Africa will, for example, mean improved coordination on common security challenges, where Africa already shoulders a significant share of the burden. Africa will also become more focused when it comes to international trade and economic growth. An integrated common market serving the world's most youthful and fastest growing population will create decades of growth opportunities for all of us. Partners such as the United States would do well to take the long view, as Africa itself is doing. Efforts that we have seen to stall or even derail the reform process are counterproductive and should be reviewed. One concrete example is the attempt through official channels to characterize the 0.2% levy on eligible imports as a violation of World Trade Organization commitments, which is not true. However, we are confident that any issues that arise can be addressed through dialogue based on mutual respect and our shared interests. What should never get lost is that we are working together in good faith and for the benefit of everyone, and with renewed determination to build a more stable and prosperous world for all of us. Once again, I wish to thank you all for finding the time for this conversation, which I'm very much looking forward to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President, for coming and for engaging in discussions with us on this important set of reforms. And I congratulate you on it. It looks really great, as well as members of the committee who worked really hard to bring about this proposal. I've told myself once I get a chance to sit down with President Kagame, there's one question that I really want to ask, and it's a broader question about reform more broadly. It's usually the often prescribed policy, reform, but it doesn't seem to be an easy process. But you have a pretty good track record with reform, and I suspect that's why you were asked by your peers to lead this process. So what is President Kagame's secret recipe, if there's such a thing, or the Kagame doctrine when it comes to reforms more broadly, and how has that helped with the current reform process?
Well, I wouldn't say there is anything so special about Kagame or Rwanda, but I'll just say, given our own history, which has been very challenging, looking at where we have been, meaning Rwanda and the long journey we have traveled to this day and the changes that have taken place and progress made, I think we have benefited from these immense challenges, because we have had to stand up and confront and, you know, deal with them in a straightforward manner, because we did not think that sitting back and doing nothing or expecting other people to come and do things for us would take us anywhere. Anyway, again, we've learned these lessons ourselves directly. So I'm not talking about stories of other places I have heard about or read. And so, and it just comes to making a decision and choices as to how you, whether you confront these challenges and improve your own situation and the lives of people involved, which was the case. For Rwanda, we are challenged by many things, as you know. It's the history, the politics, the genocide, you know, loss of a million lives in just 100 days. And but even originally, even before that, we were just a poor country and badly governed, and as may mirror what has happened in some other parts of our continent. So for us to have these, you know, if you will, two things, one that others were not experiencing, and that's the tragedy of genocide, the other which was generally shared about poverty, about bad politics, and so on. So to come out of this, there is no miracle. It's just doing what is doable by human beings. I think it's what is humanly possible. We did to simply, and we are decided, we are determined, we are focused on making sure that, no, this can't be what we deserve in the first place. This can be changed, and beginning with ourselves, even if we are to be able to get assistance from other places. So and that thinking was generally shared by the people of Rwanda, and I think catalyzed really by the kind of suffering Rwandans have gone through. I think it hardened the people, it made them, you know, more determined and decided on making these hard choices and doing even the hard work to get out of that situation and move on. So we were able to galvanize the efforts of everyone, and based on this thinking, we found we're making progress, even in a situation with limited resources. But at least the will and the determination were not limited. We were falling short on means and a few other things, but we weren't falling short on determination and dedication to do our part.
Okay. So then that has created the basis to, at least that experience was leveraged in terms of thinking about how to approach the EU reforms.
Okay. In fact, that's how maybe Africans, having seen other Africans, having seen where Rwanda has been, where we have come from, and where we are, and the progress made, they must have taken notice that, you know, it had to take certain maybe qualities or efforts or determination to actually bring about the change. And I think based on that, other than constantly sharing what has been happening in our country and what we have done to overcome these difficulties, they must have said maybe there is something here with the people of Rwanda that can help cut out these other reforms that we need across. Because again, there are similarities. There are more similarities than differences across the continent. Mm-hmm. So I think one thing led to another and influenced another. Then I think that's how they came to select Rwanda and myself to champion this, but working with other Africans that had been identified to be part of the team, each one to bring their own expertise and experiences to try and work with other Africans to cut out the overall or the broad reform across the continent.
Yeah, okay. So then the EU, an institution like the EU is obviously kind of complex in terms of ability to reform it. And it's just not the EU, I think, to a large organization like European Union, or to even see meaningful reform from the United Nations, you have to go back several decades, I think, to the sort of the 60s. So even with your experience, you must have encountered some kind of obstacles. And I think in your remarks in July, you alluded to where there's some hesitations. That should not discourage us, and that they could likely reflect misunderstandings or miscommunications, and that as a family, those can be addressed. Are we now in a position where we think such concerns have been addressed, or that they don't pose any significant threat to the reform process?
The concerns will be addressed along the way. Mm-hmm. In fact, maybe when you deal with some concerns, others merge, or even when you have, you know, brought in everybody and they have supported and even made claim to be supportive, maybe along the way again something else crops up, either by influence from wherever, and really create doubt in people who initially were not doubtful. But this is expected. I think that's where we started from. The moment you expect these challenges, so when they come up, they don't surprise you. Maybe you also plan either ahead or, you know, as they come up, how to deal with them. And it's always going to be a life of challenges. In fact, we face much bigger and more challenges by not doing what we are trying to do. So I think the challenges posed by trying to carry out reform are expected. Nonetheless, I think they can be dealt with. But, you know, once you make a step in that regard, everyone actually benefits immensely. So there is an incentive, if you will, for people to really try everything that is possible to do that. But you always find doubts, you always find excuses, you always, as happens with the changes in many regards for many things, changes are a problem unto themselves, and you just need to remain focused on the prize, the real thing you want to get at. But for challenges, Those are guaranteed.
Okay. So we're quite optimistic at this stage that the process
very
is
optimistic
on track.
Because we have seen across the continent the desire to see these reforms work. I think there are more countries, more people who have the desire to see us make improvement. Okay. I mean, everybody wants this kind of progress. Mm-hmm. So we have to deal with the few challenges, but I think with the growing numbers of countries and people mm-hmm. who are interested in making this work, mm-hmm. I have no doubt about the end result being what we want.
Okay, very good. So in your remarks, you stressed a couple of elements. One was the financing, and the other was the need for Africa to speak with one voice. And I think these are key elements of the reform. The financing decision, actually, you mentioned started earlier. And I wonder if there's been sufficient time now to be able to see whether African states are eagerly contributing the share they should be contributing to the financing of the EU. And the other processes, too, where one may be looking to gauge if there's sufficient progress could be the upcoming summits, one in Abidjan of EU-Africa partnership, and then following month in Buenos Aires, World Trade Organization. Are we getting a sense also that Africa is approaching those meetings within the framework and spirit of the reforms?
Again, it's a question of process. But to begin with, I think there was consensus that there is a need for reform. There was a need for self-financing for the EU. So that principle is very important, that mm-hmm. it generated a consensus across the continent. The problem will always be in the area of implementation. People not doing exactly what they have committed themselves to, or doing half of that, or, you know, going slowly and so on. But, for example, we have now 12 countries mm-hmm. who have actually started using this formula in just a matter of months alone. Mm-hmm. Even with the difficulties the countries were expressing mm-hmm. of going along that proposal that was made mm-hmm. because of legal, constitutional, and other matters in their own countries, mm-hmm. but because many of them were determined again. Mm-hmm. They went back home and cleared the hurdles that were there mm-hmm. so that progress will be made. You could see 11, 12 countries, taking up that and mm-hmm. doing it. So first, I think, is a very good sign. Mm-hmm. And the others were said to be doing what needs to be done, and they were talking about also speeding it up so that it starts working. But here we are not dealing with a new problem. It's a very old problem. In fact, that's indeed what probably also is associated with the complexity. The problem of Africa not being independent yeah. is has a very long history, as, mm-hmm. as you know. And of course, related to that lack of one voice representing Africa. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of challenges to overcome. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't, in any case, take away the need mm-hmm. for us to really tackle this problem. Because mm-hmm. when we're Africa, speak with one voice, when will it be independent? Because as we know, it's simple, and I just mentioned it. If someone is paying, it's very interesting because as I said, having 97% of some areas of our activities being paid from outside. One, even when we said, no, we need to start paying for ourselves, you know, those ones who were actually paying started complaining. It's yeah. like the outsiders are interested yeah. in paying our bills for everything yeah. than see us take responsibility. I mean, in between that, what do you notice? I think you find there's something very strange about it.
Yeah.
If somebody is paying my bills and I say, no, you know what, let me take a share of it or let me pay, and say, no, 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 don't worry.
Yeah.
I think it is a cause for a lot of suspicion. And why wouldn't Africans be suspicious? This is another thing.
Yeah.
We may have a problem with Africans who don't find this suspicious. It means there's something wrong, therefore we need to correct that.
Yeah.
So it's an old problem, but I think Africans across the whole continent, especially the young ones, even the old ones, I think, are beginning to say, I think there is a need to to change this old bad habit. And I think what is happening on the ground also, our situations in our countries, even for those who are insensitive, I think some things start happening that they wake up to this reality that we need to change, and it is good for us. By the way, it is also good for our partners.
Yeah.
I think our partners need to be working with Africa that wants to raise its stake in world affairs and stand up for ourselves. And you have a better partner who brings something rather than the one who keeps asking for you to give charity.
And I think in terms of that partnership, obviously one big issue is the migration, right? As you mentioned, if we're Africa, is prosperous Africa is good for everybody. And whenever we see stories about young people risking their lives to reach the shores of Europe, it's, again, a stark reminder of how we need to be doing a bit more, taking our responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the EU context, they've outlined an agenda 2063, which has some really important aspirations, really ambitious. I wanted to use this chance before I turn on to the audience for open discussion as to how likely is it, or how would a reformed EU, or let's put it this way, if the reform of the EU do not succeed for whatever reason, and we are already rooting for it to succeed, what is the likelihood of being able to fulfill those aspirations under Agenda 2063?
Well, I think the two are very closely related.
Mm-hmm.
For the ambitions or the goals of 2063, there is a pathway.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain direction you have to take to get there.
Yeah.
And part of that is making the reform work.
Mm-hmm.
They are really tied in together. So unless 2063 continues to become wishful thinking, but we have to create these pathways that will lead us there, and one of them is to be able to do these things mostly ourselves, be able to finance our activities, because we can. You see, it's very... But that most of these countries in Africa, I mean, we can't keep having Africa that is, so wealthy in terms of all kinds of resources. but at the same time, we have poor Africans.
Yeah, that's a paradox. Yeah.
We really need, we have to bridge the gap. Mm. And one way is through these reforms, is through implementation, follow-up on doing things. Mm-hmm. And there is no lack of knowledge as to what we need to do. Largely, all Africans, the leaders, the citizens, mm-hmm. whoever you talk about, they are already, the majority are aware of what needs to be done. Mm. It's just, you know, pushing that button to make sure that everybody, other than thinking, mm. the actions also really accompany that, and we, so that we change things. I think we will get there, and the two are tied. It's the reform process, it's the 2063 agenda, it's the mindset change that we have to even look back and say, why are we here?
Yeah.
Where others have been but have left us and have gone so far ahead. Mm-hmm. What is it? What's wrong with Africa? We need to answer this question. Yeah, it's not a curse. Mm. It's just that, yeah, it can't be, because most of these advanced economies, unfortunately, actually are contributed to by Africans, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. If these Africans could really start doing some of the things they know they could help with within our continent, and if our political systems could allow that to happen. And of course, when I say that, I'm talking about leaders at different levels who really have authority, power, responsibility in their hands. Mm-hmm. We need to change things, otherwise they just won't change mm-hmm. without us doing what we need to do.
Yeah. Okay, so with this, I'll turn over to the audience, open it up for questions. I'm sure you've been eagerly waiting to get into the discussion. Yes, Ambassador.
Thank you very much, Corey.
And if you would, please, as you come to ask questions, state your name and your affiliation. That would be great. Thank you.
I'm Liberata Mulamula. They call me Ambassador. I'm now with the George Washington University. Mr. President, karibu sana.
Asante.
I'm now on the other side.
Which side?
So I can be feel free to pose a question. Mr. President, this week we have had round tables. There's, I'm sure you are familiar with this constituents for Africa. We had round tables at the African Union, at the George Washington University. One of the round tables was about empowering the next generation of leaders. And this was the most challenging round table, because we had the youth, the students, putting us to task. And this, of course, also was in the framework of the African Union. They said, we hear about these reforms, we hear about all these initiatives, but then we don't see the youth, the young people at the table. And when they are at the table, they are not engaged in the conversation. So I'm putting this to you because I'm also teaching about gender and leadership in Africa. And the question every time that comes around is Africa Union, in terms of the leadership, is a man club. But also for things like the reforms, he said you are just speaking among yourselves. You need to have a new trajectory. You need to have to bring this youth, these young minds, that they use technology. For example, when you talk of 0.2%, how you do it, I don't know, but then they say we can also bring the tools to see how best you can have this implemented. So the question I'm putting to you, which you should help me to be able to come back to this, to these youth and the young leaders, on what is the inspiration, what is the hope for them to get to engage the African leaders? So this is my question. Thank you.
Yeah. But I think it is not entirely true that the young people are not engaged, because I've been to places where the young people have been engaged. Well, in some cases, maybe they are not where they really should be expected to be, but that doesn't go for every case. But I think the point being made is clear. The point we are making is, in all these processes, we should involve everybody, and particularly the young people. I think that's the point that has been made for a long time, wherever you go. So I don't disagree with that, not at all. I think, one, everybody who has what to contribute should be engaged. Two, the young people especially have a lot to offer, and they should therefore be brought in as a way not only of communicating to them what there is, but also making them, you know, get involved and probably taking some of the responsibilities they should. Having said that, I think we will need to correct, and maybe this can be corrected by the way we communicate. We need to, first of all, involve the youth. Those who have responsibility at different levels need to think about that. And really, because there is a lot we can tap, you know, from them. But I think the young people should feel they have that responsibility to show up. They need to be there. They need to show up. They can't be there and say, no, they didn't call me, so... You know, the responsibility should be shared, really. Yes, the young people, they are important. But you see, when you are important and say, okay, I'm important, but so somebody should recognize that and come to me, then there is a problem. The young people are important. They are needed. They should show up. They should come forward. And even in demand. And actually say, no, we want to be part of this. It's their right to demand. So, again, it's a long journey. It won't happen overnight. It won't happen just because somebody remembers to do that and another one doesn't. And then the young people, so sometimes they are there. Another time they are not there. We need all to move, to get things moving and come forward and do some of these things. But the point is taken. The young people, tell them, I completely agree with you. They should be involved, but they should really show up.
Yeah. And actually, to underscore that point, one of the key proposals in the EU reform, I believe, is actually to set up quotas for young people and women.
Women, yes. Yeah.
I think the gentleman in the third row, the glasses, is next.
Hi, Mr. President. My name is Anesu. I'm from Zimbabwe, and I'm a young person, and I'm going to show up. I'm showing up, exactly.
That's a good example.
In fact, I'm going to set a proposal that whatever committee is going to be formed for young people, I'm inviting myself to that committee. Okay. My question really is, I'm a master's student for international development here in Washington, D.C. at the School for International Training. My question really is about to do with financing. I hear the African Union is really focusing on how we should finance ourselves. But as I look at it, most African countries don't have that capacity to finance themselves, let alone the African Union. So I'll give an example of, for example, if I am a business person in Zimbabwe and I have a product, I will choose to go and sell that product in Europe because I'll get more money than going at that product maybe in Zambia because they probably won't pay me as much as I have. So shouldn't we be focusing more on how to really build our economies to be functional economies and really have those currencies that we need so that we have enough capacity to fund not just the African Union, but our own countries? What focus is happening towards that direction? That's my question.
But it is not either or. When we were talking about being able to finance our activities, we weren't talking about stopping countries growing their economies at all. We are saying they should happen at the same time. But it is also not true, if you look at every country across the continent, actually what is asked of them to pay their share of burden for the EU is something they can afford. And it's not a flat kind of contribution. Those who have more contribute more than others. Those who have less will contribute less. I think that was taken care of. It's not a big thing. But there is a problem here that maybe we may be missing. Even things as they stand today, before this formula was given, and initially countries were not even complaining that they are being asked to pay more than they are capable of. That hasn't become an issue. But of course, what we find is that some countries among those who are actually known to have resources don't even pay. And not paying doesn't have relationship with being capable or not to pay. It is just the will to pay or the understanding of what that does that should be positive for the continent. So it's a lot of, I think there is more politics involved and the will to really say advancing the cause of the continent is advancing your own cause as a country.
Right.
There is a sort of disconnect. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, I think you're next.
Good afternoon, Your Excellency. I'm Ambassador Kanachiombori. I'm your African Union Ambassador to the United States. Mine is a comment. And I just wanted to thank you first and foremost for what you have done for the women of Rwanda. And hopefully you will duplicate that in the rest of the continent. For those of you who do not know, Rwanda has a 64% female cabinet. No country in the world comes
in
even close.
Parliament.
Parliament, yes, parliament, yes. 64%.
Yeah. And 40-something in the cabinet. That's it.
So for that, we want to thank you. And those are some of the things that we need to highlight as we engage our conversations about Africa. And to my sister, Ambassador, I wanted to say for you, to your students, you need to let your students know that for you to be able to contribute to the development of Africa, first and foremost, you must stand up and be counted. We have no idea who you are and where you are. The Indian diaspora are organized. Their voices are loud and clear. The Chinese, the Indian, the Irish, the Japanese, you name it. The diaspora from other ethnic groups are very organized. When you ask for the voices of the African diaspora, go to the graveyard, because we are nowhere to be heard. Yeah. So before the leadership can stand up and help us, they must know where we are and what we are doing. So tell your young people and you young men from Zimbabwe, stand up and be counted so we can speak for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Then,
I think
please, Dr.
The African Union is well represented.
Thank you, Your Excellency. First, my name is Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. I'm on the advisory board along with Donald Kabaruka of this African Growth Initiative. So among other things. So I wanted to first say congratulations to Cool and AGI and Brookings for doing this. This is the kind, bringing one of our top leaders to discuss an issue of great substance. This is where we want to go. But I wanted to push His Excellency a bit. He has done some remarkable reforms in Rwanda that really matter, which is the open borders. Anyone African, I understand now, can come in without a visa. You have agreements with several other countries for a joint visa to move around. I think every African, if we're really to make progress on trade and other economic issues, we want these open borders for people to be able to move around. It's like the one reform that Africans could see and really feel. So I wanted to say, how can you share your experience and the good results you're getting from this policy and push all of us on the continent to go the same way?
Yes. Very good. Well, I wish pushing all of you would yield results, and we will try. But the best push comes in the way, indeed, of example. There are these things we have tried to do in our own country, basically in our own self-interest, meaning the benefits that come from what we are doing are primarily experienced by Rwandans who have done that. But this, I think, may benefit others by working as an example of what is possible. In fact, some of the things we have done, it's like we are telling our brothers and sisters on the continent that if Rwanda can do it, you can do it. For example, on the question of opening our borders, all Africans find a visa at the airport when they are coming to Rwanda. There is no hassle for visas to Rwanda and even some other countries, but specifically for the Africans. And the demonstration here was also to tell Africans, because some of them think if they open their borders, everybody will come, wrong people will come and cause problems in these countries. We haven't received wrong people causing us problems. So if I tell the rest of our continent and the world that actually by being open, we haven't met any new problems that have come because of that. That's very true. Yes, it would be. But, and that's where our push is in that form, because there is no way one country can push other countries to do what the country thinks is right or what is even working for them. But if you keep showing this example, if the way we have involved women in the whole structure of our economy and the way it has worked, 52% of our population are women. And we have involved women as much as they should be, because it's not even a favor we are doing women. It's really, we are doing ourselves a favor, the whole country. Everybody is participating, and then the rights are being also respected of everyone. So maybe the harmony in Rwanda, the stability and the continued growth of our economy, can easily be attributed to this approach that everybody is involved, and particularly women who have been left behind before, and it still exists in other places, are actually part of this stability, continued growth, and so on and so forth. It's a benefit. If anyone can find sense in that and maybe apply it for a similar situation, I think that's how it works. But constantly, and we have had the beauty of it again, and relating it to questions asked earlier, Africans are eager to have things change. That's what it is. And we have seen many countries, country delegations, one after another, come to Rwanda to ask us, say, how did you do this? What are the results? What are the obstacles? We have many country delegations coming to share, as we have done ourselves. We've gone to places and to say, how did you do this? Yeah. Yes, and we go and do it. The difference is always going to be, are you going to do it?
Yes. Or will you give up when it gets hard?
That's the whole thing, absolutely. Yeah. If you don't give up, if you really do it, if you keep trying, so it will work.
So we may just have time for just one more question, and then we'll have His Excellency have the last word before we wrap up. Monday.
My name is Monde Muyango. I'm the director of the Africa Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center. I wanted to follow up on this question about financing of the African Union. There are lots of us who are cheering you on and all the work, the hard work that Rwanda and members of the committee have done to ensure that Africa owns the African Union, because without that, the future of that continent is actually quite bleak. My question to you is this. We know that some African countries, including quite a few in the Southern African Development Community, are pushing back on the 0.2% levy. Now, is that a question of the modalities that have been defined for contributing that 2%? Or is it a question of the note verbal that was sent regarding the WTO, that is presenting some fear about what the possible economic repercussions might be? Or is it the case that there are some countries, both within Africa and outside, who are afraid of what an efficient and effective AU might mean for the future?
I think simply and straightforward, that last one. It's very clear. Because you find even some of those who really initially had no problem, they liked it, they supported it. Then after some weeks, they start saying, no, but you see this and this. You really ask, you engage, you explain, and then you start saying, okay, what is the alternative? And they can't give you the alternative. So I think you've really answered the question without... Thank you.
Which is perhaps why we really need to do this. Yes. So unfortunately, that's all the time we had. Really thank you, His Excellency, for joining us and sharing your perspective. Certainly here at the Africa Growth Initiative, we'll be following the reforms, the progress, and we hope to be able to welcome you in the future to discuss at that time, hopefully, how the reform already implemented are contributing to prosperity on the continent. So if you would, if you don't mind remaining sitting for the next minute or so as His Excellency makes his exit from the building, I appreciate it. And thanks you all for coming.
Well, but let me first thank you and the Brookings Institute for giving us this opportunity and the audience here that was very interesting, and I'll always be happy to come and share with you matters related to this reform or any other matters as an African, a very proud African.
Thank you.